Hello and welcome to Russians with Attitude. Tonight with us a special guest, Big Serge. Hello, Serge.
Good evening, gentlemen. Hope you're doing well. I'm tucked in with a glass of Borjomi mineral water, so I'm looking forward to this, and thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for replying instantly about the drink question. That's very nice of you. Yes, so for those who are unaware, Serge is an Orthodox Christian American man who likes to read, make history threads on x.com, and generally he is one of the best posters right now. Not many know, actually, but your avatar is a photo of Sergei Witte, statesman of late Russian imperial times. The man that was responsible for introducing the gold standard and civil liberties in 1905 manifest and all that. So why did you choose him as your avatar?
Yeah, that's a good question. So a lot of it has to do with the sort of affinity that I have for him. As you know, he was a bit of a technocrat, began in the railroads, something of a math whiz. And so you could say that he had a low ideological content and was more of a practical technocratic figure. And I have some affinity for him in that regard. I won't go into it, but in my professional life, I'm adjacent to, call it, actuarial work. So he and I, we both have a nice sort of engineer's practical mindset. And, yeah, you know, I find that admirable, just plugging away, doing the work.
Yeah. Well, yeah, he also was a key person responsible for building the Trans-Siberian Railway. Personally, the man, although everyone admitted that he was very smart, but no one really liked him. But maybe because he was so good at what he does. Another question. Also, about the drink question, I am drinking some green tea blend called iced lemon, and it's pretty good.
Okay, I'm having a coffee right now because I've been tired all day.
An interesting fact about Witte. Witte liked, with every meal that he had, he drank half a bottle of champagne, not more, not less. It was the exact half a bottle of champagne. Very weird choice, I think, but yeah.
He had a robust constitution. He was a big guy, if you see some of the pictures.
He liked to eat a lot.
Yeah.
And he was lamenting that people will forget what he did, what he achieved, and he hoped that some dish would be named after him, like Beef Stroganoff, and yeah, it did not happen, but people still did not forget about him. But yeah, let's talk about you. You don't talk about your own life that much, and I understand that, but I've got to ask you, how did you become an Orthodox Christian while being an American? And what is your ethnic background, maybe?
Yeah, so I'm a typical ethnically blended American. My ethnic background is all peoples, let's say, adjacent to the Arctic Circle. So it's a mixture of Scandinavian. I do have some bona fide Slav in there. And it is a typical American story. And there's always some Irish. Most Americans have a little bit of Irish because they got around everywhere. So a Northern European blend, a pretty typical American profile of R1B and R1A for our haplogroup enjoyers. And, you know, kind of typical American story where I had been raised to various forms of Protestant and was dissatisfied with the sort of vapid quality of a lot of American Protestantism. And the Slavic portion of my ethnicity came out, I guess, in one. And so I converted to Orthodoxy. This was many years ago at this point. I was well ahead of sort of the current trend that you see on Twitter with a lot of fascination with Orthodoxy among Americans. And so I was ahead of the curve and pretty well positioned for current events because I had an early conversion to Orthodoxy and a longstanding fascination with Russian history, military history. So I didn't know it, but I was positioning myself for 2022.
Exactly. Yes, because you created your Twitter account exactly in 2022. And is this the first account, actually?
Yeah, I don't have any prior accounts, prior bans, or anything like that. I'm actually not a particularly technological person, but when the war started and kind of seeing some of the commentary, I just, a lot of it was really bothering me, and just the quality of it. I won't name names. You know, this was even before NAFO, like right when it all started the Saint Javelin iconography, and it, yeah, I couldn't stay on the sideline and felt like I wanted to make some commentary. I didn't expect it to blow up the way it did, of course, but you know, stranger things have happened.
Yeah, neither did we.
I remember when the war first started in February, you guys were running like a 24/7 Twitter ship trying to keep everybody updated on everything.
Oh yeah, I slept like 8 hours total in the first week of the war or so.
The first week was a little surreal.
Yeah.
Eventually you realize you're not going to be able to stay like that the entirety of it.
Yeah.
At the time, it was really unknown territory because, well, conflicts of this scale, well, never happened in our lifetime, and especially so close to us and involving us and my country. Chechen wars are no comparison. The SMO was certainly a turning point for us and for you as well, and many people across the world. So for Russians and Ukrainians, I think it was a stress test of our belief systems, and many people have switched sides, and a lot of it was actually kind of positive. There are many ex-Navalnyites in Russia who saw how wrong they were and became a bit more reasonable. Yeah, but some, of course, have gone to the deep end, and our mission, as the war reports in kind of a channel, was to remain as objective as possible while openly stating what country we are from. Of course, people who claim that they're 100% neutral observers flying in the sky are just lying. So I think it's more fair to just state who are you rooting for while remaining as clear-headed as possible. So, yeah. And what was it like for you, Serge, the 2022 and all that?
Yeah, so I don't pretend to be Russian by nationality. I obviously have affinity for Russians. As an Orthodox Christian, you meet a lot of Slavic people, you become very close to them. I do have a bit of family tie to Russia, but I don't pretend that I'm a first generation Russian American or anything like that. I do have affinity for Russia, but more broadly, just as an American, I felt that the American position on Ukraine was very shameful because people know nothing about the Ukrainian state. And from my view, this was essentially a gangster state. And for America to throw itself behind it, I found a little bit embarrassing. And more broadly, from an interest perspective, I've always felt that America has no vital interests anywhere inside the perimeter of the old Warsaw Pact, right? And so I'm opposed to, on a pragmatic level, I'm opposed to what I view as American imperial overextension and needlessly generating or sustaining conflict where we have no interest. Plus, I think most Americans would like Russians if they knew any. And so it just strikes me as odd and kind of sad to see Americans, Westerners referring to Russians as orcs and other various things and sort of mindlessly jumping on board Ukrainian propaganda without understanding what they're talking about, right? Because fun fact, America and Russia have actually been on the same side in pretty much every global war, right, until now. And it just struck me as sad.
As to your point about America supporting Ukraine, well, knowing nothing about them, well, isn't it just typical? And U.S. supported wars, people, and states in history, in recent history. So I don't think that you can easily make this case, because it's very murky territory. Have you tried talking to Americans anywhere? And how would you sway people into believing that the Ukraine is a rogue state?
Well, I mean, the plight of the people in the Donbas is objectively one that people would be sympathetic to if they understood the history. And people don't understand that. Most Americans, all they really see is the different dimensions of the countries on the map. So they see what they perceive as a big country picking on a smaller country. And they don't really feel the need to think any deeper than that. So when I have conversations with people, you know, you try to explain the history of the Donbas region, and Russia's position is actually fairly sympathetic and easy to understand. Ukraine is a country with a large ethnic Russian population that was turning itself into an explicitly anti-Russian state. And so it's not hard to understand what that means for ethnic Russians living there. So I think that when people understand a little bit more, they do see the plight of the Donbas as somewhat sympathetic. And of course, there are people that have been so heavily propagandized that you're really not going to get through. But I think that the story of the Donbas is intrinsically sympathetic to people once they understand what's happened.
It's not like unprincipled exceptions to our like a new thing in politics in that sense. Like 100 years ago, it was just about the same. After World War One, you had both the Entente talking about the right to self-determination of nations, but for some reason it was did not apply to like Hungary, for example, or Austria. And at the same time, you had the Bolsheviks in Russia saying the exact same thing, like the right to self-determination of nations was supposed to be a guiding principle of communism as well, just as it was with liberalism. But you have basically Soviet politicians admitting that they did go against it when they carved up the republics. Like I don't remember who it was, actually. I think Rykov or someone specifically stated that, yes, we did, for example, Estonia. We did put a 100% ethnically Russian piece of land into Estonia for pragmatic reasons that have like nothing to that go counter against the principle of national self-determination. But like people don't care about these abstract principles, really. It's I don't think anyone really takes that seriously when it concerns them and their interests. I just have, in general, a very cynical view of these concepts.
And the other thing about Ukraine that I've said this to a couple people, and it makes them think, is if you think that Ukraine's borders are just these perfectly and ideally crafted constructions, this is a very powerful endorsement of the Soviet Union, which of course determines the internal geography, right? The post-Soviet borders are an artifact of Soviet government, right? And it's frankly just a miracle that the Soviet Union broke up so cleanly along the, you know, internally drawn lines. But Ukraine's borders were exogenously imposed by Soviet governments. They're not actually some sort of organic manifestation of a Ukrainian nation per se, right? And we understand this, but people don't, they really have never put any thought into that.
Well, yeah, it's a bit like the colonialist borders in Africa and in the Middle East that don't really make much sense. All those completely straight lines in Africa. The only way to really evaluate whose land it is to have endless wars. And that's the European way. The problem was that the Soviet Union acted as this colonizer in a way, and left us with all those faulty borders, and not only in the Ukrainian case, but also in the Karabakh case.
Yeah, I think it's particularly obvious in the Caucasus just how stupid the borders are. Specifically in the case of Karabakh, you had basically the Bolsheviks, the Caucasian Bureau of the RSDRP was mostly pro-Armenian, and they drew up borders that were very sympathetic to Armenia at first. But then Orjonikidze, for some reason, didn't like Armenia. Like, it was just a personal dislike. He then tasked his comrade Maharadze withdrawing new borders, which were now pro-Azeri. And that's how it happened. And there is no deeper reasoning to this. And it's just very arbitrary. And it does strike me as very inconsistent when you have staunch American Cold Warriors stuck in 80s mindset, stating that they are willing to nuke the world to preserve internal Soviet administrative borders.
Yes, and Soviet internal borders were often incoherent simply in the sense that it was never anticipated that the Union would break up, right? These borders were designed under the implicit assumption that the Union would last, well, maybe forever, but certainly longer than, 80 years. So they certainly look incoherent after breakup, because the breakup of the USSR was unthinkable to administrative leadership in the early days of the Union. They never foresaw an intellect like Gorbachev. It never would have, dawned on them that someone could just unwind the whole thing in a few years.
And particularly in the example of Ukraine, it wasn't even, it was very controversial, the inclusion of Donetsk and Kharkiv into the Ukrainian Soviet Republic, because they did have their own Soviet Republic, the Donetsk-Kryvyi-Rih Soviet Republic, which was led by Comrade Artyom, a very influential Soviet politician who was very good friends with Kirov and Stalin. And it was just after internal politicking that he lost, and the Donetsk-Kryvyi-Rih Soviet Republic was included and was dissolved and included in the Ukrainian Soviet Republic. So most of what we perceive as Novorossiya, well, excluding Kherson and Odessa, was not even part of Soviet Ukraine in the first years of the Soviet Union's existence.
Right. And the broader point is that for Americans who perceive this as just a big, bad country picking on a little innocent country, yeah, they don't understand that what you're seeing on the map are artifacts of internal Soviet deliberations, internal Soviet politics. Right. They don't understand that they're perceiving a sort of a ghost of Soviet internal deliberations on the map. And that just, it never occurs to them, right? Because they think all borders are some sort of reflection of organic history, right? Even though that's clearly not the case if you look at Africa or the Middle East.
Yeah.
But Putin paved the way for us to talk about this, since he normalized historical spurging in the Tucker Carlson interview.
Yeah. Well, there is an interesting question from the audience. In the past, you, Serge, have rightly said that one flaw of Russia in the SMO is a lack of escalation credibility. Putin have drawn red lines and failed to retaliate when those red lines were crossed. If you were in charge, what are some escalation tactics you might use that don't risk the conflict spilling over beyond the limited scope Putin wishes to keep it in?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right? Because NATO seems to be able to act with impunity, providing ISR for Ukraine continually. It's funny at this point that at one point we were deliberating if, would NATO actually send main battle tanks? And that seems so long ago. Now it seems like a foregone conclusion that there will be F-16s, even though these things won't really alter the outcome on the battlefield. They do matter because they sustain Ukrainian combat power. So they do prolong the conflict, even if they don't change the ultimate calculus. So a lot of these red lines have come and gone. NATO is obviously very deeply involved in the planning, targeting, equipping, training, really every layer of Ukrainian war making. And it seems that Putin is unwilling to strike outside of the Ukrainian theater. And this looks, this can look a little weak when you compare it to, for example, Iran, which is striking American installations via its proxies, rather with impunity right now. So it seems like Iran really just ramped up the intensity very quickly compared to Putin's more cautious windup. This is pretty consistent with Putin, though, because, and this is why I laugh when people in America talk about how he's this massively expansionist Hitlerian figure, when the reality is Putin seems to drag his feet all through, you know, the Minsk Accords, and he was very reluctant to act directly in Ukraine. And even now he continues to signal that he'd like a peace settlement. So at a certain point, we have to just admit that this is a personal predilection of Putin to act pretty cautiously. I think that you've started to see some answers in Ukraine. There's been more strikes on command centers in the Ukrainian rear that presumably have impacted in NATO's presence in planning and operations. So I think that was an important step. Broadly, I think Putin believes, most likely correctly, that he can win the war without taking any aggressive steps to escalate outside of the Ukrainian theater. I think that it's very much, he's slow walking it because he wants to contain the conflict, right? And that's why the Western propaganda saying that Putin is going to invade the Baltic states and then he's going to invade Poland and portraying this as a Hitlerian march to European empire, it's just so hilariously at odds with the way he's actually behaving, because his priority seems to be containing the conflict to Eastern Ukraine. And so they have a well-shaped front right now. It's very easily supplied. They have a full spectrum overmatch and a variety of arms. And I think you're not going to see escalation from Russia at the current trajectory, because they're just content to endure Western provocations because the calculus on the battlefield is so positive for Russia.
I think most of the support for Ukraine in the US comes from a place of cynicism. It looks like a win-win situation to the elites, because you're being a good guy for stepping up for a small victim, Ukraine, against this big bully that is Russia. Then you are revitalizing your own military industrial complex, and of course you create jobs, right? While at the same time you're losing no soldiers of your own. Well, maybe a dozen of mercs, and that's it. So the only possible risk in all of this is the nuclear escalation, but that's where this tactic of Schrödinger's Putin comes into play. Putin is crazy Hitlerian figure, but he also will never nuke anyone. And it's a gamble. So it's a gamble that they're ready to make. Yeah.
Yeah. People call him Cuckler because he's Putler, he's Hitler, but he's also a cuck who won't do anything. But which would seem to be
very
a paradox,
convenient. So isn't it just beneficial to pursue this very strategy that the US is doing right now?
Well,
that's enough for a free segment. The full episode is available for our glorious allies on Patreon and Gumroad. See you there.